Welcome to Denko-e Sesshin. This might be the 9th annual Denko-e Sesshin we've done here, celebrating the stories and the awakenings of our Zen ancestors in India, China, and Japan, based on the Denko Roku, the record of transmitting the light. Our recent visiting Japanese priest, Reverend Taiga, some of you met, he confirmed to me that this is an annual tradition at Sojiji, where he trained. This is Keizan Zenji's monastery in Japan. They have Denko-e Sesshin every year. I think it's like several weeks long. It's longer than we do. Longer than the usual Sesshin, where they go through many of the stories. And so our two kind of co-founders, we sometimes say, of Japanese Soto Zen are Dogen Zenji, lived in the 1200s, and Keizan Zenji lived in the 1300s, four generations later. And together they brought forth this tradition that we still practice here in Santa Cruz. Dogen's main writing is the Shogo Genzo. So there's Genzo-e Sesshins that were practiced a lot of Zazen and study the Shogo Genzo. And there's Denko-e Sesshins where they practice a lot of Zazen and study the Denko Roku. And this is kind of about history. Right? This is like these ancient stories that have been told for century after century. It's like our family stories of our ancestors. So I think, for me, it feels like a beautiful part of this Denko-e Sesshin is hearing the stories and the history of our lineage, and also hearing about how each ancestor awakened to the light. That's the focus of these stories. We hear about their lives, but the central story in each chapter is their awakening story, each one completely different. So for some historical context, if we go all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha, he was born in northern India and actually present-day Nepal in around 500 BC. And then as time went along, his teachings spread throughout that whole subcontinent of India. And eventually, about 500 years after the Buddha's time, the Dharma made it into China, which is quite close to India, but a very different culture. So this is around the year zero that in our counting system, like the first century, when the Dharma started to percolate into the great vast country that we now call China. And in China, around the time of Buddha, around the time 500 BC. Supposedly that's when Lao Tzu lived. We might call sort of a founder of Taoism. He said things like, the way that can be spoken of is not the true way. So there's some, you know, similarities to Buddha Dharma around the time Buddha was born. And Confucius was also lived around 500 BC in China, and he was really into harmonious conduct and how society can live harmoniously and by honoring ancestors and keeping rituals that harmonize people. There's a combination of the kind of non-institutional Taoism in the mountains and mixing with this more societal tradition of Confucianism made a nice fertile ground for Indian Buddha Dharma to come into China and kind of mix with those traditions. So it was about 500 years after Buddhism made it into China that Bodhidharma came on the scene. Apparently the first few centuries in China, Buddhidharma was kind of a small movement for a few hundred years. People were translating the Indian texts. That was a big part of bringing the tradition to a new country. And there were monastics practicing, and it was working its way into society, but slowly. But then after a few centuries, it somehow started growing. And by the time of Bodhidharma, around 500, one record says there were 2 million Buddhist monks in China, and tens of thousands of Buddhist temples. So something kind of took off there, and I think often the government has to do with these things. There's politics involved and how religion works into a society. So when we say Bodhidharma is our first Chinese ancestor, he's the first ancestor of Zen. The Buddhadharma was in China for 500 years, but a little different than Bodhidharma's way. So that's where today's story can begin, with Bodhidharma, the 28th Indian Zen ancestor and the first Chinese Zen ancestor. I thought it would be very sweet to celebrate these first Chinese ancestors in this transmission of light record. It's somewhere in the middle of this book. It goes through all the 28 Indian ancestors, and it goes past Bodhidharma all the way up to Dogen and Dogen's disciple in Japan. So Bodhidharma is somewhere in the middle, but these first generations of Zen ancestors in China, I feel like these are maybe my favorite stories. These early ancestors, they're like really point at the heart of our practice, and they're well-known stories. So I think it's a nice place to take up this record this weekend. Bodhidharma, of course, was born in India, and his teacher was Prajñātara, who lived in southern India. And for maybe like the last 10, 15 years, there's this rumor been circulating in Zen halls in America that Bodhidharma's teacher, Prajñātara, was a woman. You might have heard this. Yeah. I say it's somewhat recently because we have these a couple of books of Zen women ancestors, like by Grace Shearson and Sally Tinsdale, and they don't mention Prajñātara. I think this rumor hadn't started spreading yet. And you know, I tried to research, and all I found, I think it's coming mainly from this one source, that's a disciple of Jiyu Kennett Roshi, who was a woman teacher herself in America, one of the founding Zen teachers in America, Soto Zen, and she got a great thing going up at Shasta Abbey, and a lot of people practiced there, so many that she could have one of the temple positions was called her research assistant. That's what they did. They were like a kind of scholar and researcher. She had translators too. They did a lot of work. This researcher whose name was Reverend Koten Benson, she asked him to do this work of seeing if there's any women ancestors in our lineage. She said that her teacher in Japan mentioned at some point there are women teachers in our lineage, but he didn't mention who. So he did this research, and unfortunately it's I don't know if he knew more but didn't write it down in accessible ways. Maybe Shasta Abbey knows more. But apparently he found out that some Korean Zen lineages do understand that Prajñātara was a woman. I think in China that got kind of lost, that information. And so I don't know how the Korean Zen people discovered this, but maybe the main thing, he says there's even archaeological evidence, but at least there's the stories in the area of Kerala. Kerala is like the southern tip of India. And this is near where the records say that Prajñātara and Bodhidharma lived. That the people of Kerala have been telling these stories about Prajñātara and Bodhidharma and passing it on, maybe kind of oral transmission of these stories, and that Prajñātara is a woman. I would love to hear more, and I think many people in America would love to hear more. And I did hear from Reverend Gita. Does anyone know Gita, who's living at Tassajara? She's was the Eno at Tassajara. She was, I think, born in and lives in Tamil Nadu, the state in India next to Kerala, which incidentally is where Ramana Maharshi, the great Indian saint, lived. And so this summer she told me that she says, yes, the people of Kerala, down near where she lives, do have these tales of Prajñātara as a woman, great adept Indian teacher. And I said, well, is there anything written about this? And she said, I don't know. These are they're kind of folk stories. But there probably is written. And I encourage her, see if we can, she would be the one who knows Hindi, and I'll translate these if there's anything written. So if any of you want to go to southern India and find out more. So that's Prajñātara. We don't know that person's gender, but may have been a woman according to these local stories. And but the Chinese Zen texts always treat him like a male. So this is now 500 years after. Actually, now it's 1,000 years after the Buddha's time. Buddhism's flourishing in China and India, and Prajnataras living in southern India. I'll translate it as she. So this transmission of light record by Keizan Zenji. Now, he's living in the 1300s, talking about the 500s. And incidentally, while we're on the topic of women ancestors, the first Soto Zen Dharma heir, lineage holder in Japan, was a disciple of Keizan Zenji. He passed Soto Zen Dharma to Acharya Ekyu. Ekyu. And he had several other women disciples too. So now it's like the normal thing, right? But I think in throughout Buddhist history, especially Zen, it was such a male-dominated tradition. At least what gets recorded. So the 28th ancestor was Venerable Bodhidharma. This is now Keizan telling the story from other Chinese records, and then he's going to comment on the story. Once the 27th ancestor, Venerable Prajnatara, asked, "What among all things is signless?" Bodhidharma replied, "Non-arising is signless." Prajnatara asked, "What among all things is the greatest?" Bodhidharma replied, "The true nature of things is the greatest." That's the kind of central story, the case, call it here. And now, what's called the circumstances, or a little bit of the background story of these ancestors. Bodhidharma was a member of the warrior ruler class, Kshatriya class caste, we could say, in India. And his name was originally Bodhitara. Maybe just coincidence that his teacher's name that he would eventually meet is named Prajnatara. This was before he met Prajnatara. His name was Bodhitara. Tara with a long A on the end is like, you know, the goddess Tara, I think, means like savioress. And Tara is something like to save, I think, in Sanskrit. And Bodhi is awakening. And Prajna is like wisdom. So this is Bodhitara. He was the third son of the king of Kanchi. This is in present-day Tamil Nadu, in southern India. In southern India. The king's respect for the Buddha Dharma was above the ordinary. So Bodhitara would later become Bodhidharma, was a prince, the son of a Raja, a king. And this king was a devotee of Buddha Dharma. Once he gave the Dharma teacher, Prajnatara, a precious jewel as alms. The king had three sons, Chandra Vimalatara, Punyatara, and Bodhitara. Maybe he actually named his sons after his teacher, Prajnatara. That seems maybe kind of likely, since they all have Tara in their name. And he was very devoted to Prajnatara. Venerable Prajnatara wanted to test the wisdom of the princes, these, the three sons of the king. He showed them this jewel, that he'd been given by his teacher. I mean, patron, and asked, "Does anything compare with this jewel?" The first two sons said, "This jewel is the most precious of the seven treasures, and truly nothing can surpass it." So, precious treasures are like, you know, gold and silver and lapis lazuli, and it's like one of those Indian lists of gemstones. It became a Buddhist list. "This jewel is the most precious of the seven treasures, and truly nothing can surpass it. No one without the venerable Prajnatara's power of the way could receive it." The third son, Bodhitara, said, "This is just a worldly treasure, and still does not qualify as the best. I consider the treasure of the Dharma, the truth, to be the best of treasures. The light of this jewel is a worldly light and still does not qualify as the best. I consider the light of wisdom to be the best of lights." Light here, by the way, is ko, as in denko roku, the light that is transmitted. "This is worldly clarity or brightness and still does not qualify as the best. I consider the brightness or clarity of mind to be the best of all brightnesses." Well, no, and it might have even been written in China, but in Chinese, Sino-Japanese, it's shinyo. Shin is chitta in Sanskrit. And myo, yeah, like prabha. Maybe we could say chitta prabha, the mind's luminosity or brightness. I consider the brightness of mind to be the best of brightnesses. The bright light of this jewel cannot illuminate itself, but needs the light of wisdom in order for it to be discerned. So this physical jewel, it's pretty bright and shiny, this bright jewel that Prajnatara is holding, but it can't illuminate itself. It needs the light of wisdom to illuminate it. And he doesn't go on to say, but I think the implication is, the best of lights, the best of jewels, can illuminate itself. Unlike this mineral, this jewel of the mind is self-illuminating. He doesn't say it, but I think that's kind of implied. That's why it's the best. It can not only illuminate other jewels, but it can illuminate itself. So it's a long story, so I'm going to skip some of it. When Prajnatara heard this explanation of Bodhitara, he knew a sage had been born. He discerned that Bodhitara would be a Dharma successor, but the time had not yet come, so he remained silent and let Bodhitara remain with the others. Skipping ahead a bit. Later, Bodhitara's father, the king, died. As seems to be the case with basically everyone. While people were grieving, Bodhitara alone entered samadhi in front of the coffin of his father. So they were all kind of grieving, but But the son, Bodhidharma, got very, very still sitting in front of this coffin of his father. Sometimes the stillness of death invokes the stillness in us, if we're close to the deceased especially. And I don't, this seems like kind of as Prajnatara knew a sage had been born, maybe he is kind of a special kind of guy here, Prajnatara, because after 7 days he came out of samadhi. They maybe had already like moved the coffin away and done the cremation and whatever. After 7 days he came out of samadhi and he went to Prajnatara and asked to leave home. Say, shuke, it says. This leaving home is our name for ordination. He wanted to be ordained as a priest. Now that maybe something about his father dying awakened his noble urgency in the face of the transiency of human life. This is where I'm going. This is where we're all going. Let's try to get to the bottom of what this is all about. This business of life and death. Immediately after coming out of samadhi, he went to Prajnatara and said, "Will you ordain me?" And Prajnatara knew that the time had come, and so he let Bodhidharma leave home and receive the precepts. Afterward, Bodhidharma did zazen for 7 more days in Prajnatara's room, and Prajnatara instructed him extensively in the wonderful principles of zazen. Seems like he was already a pretty good meditator if he was in this like samadhi space where he wasn't didn't even know any time had passed for 7 days, but there's many kinds of samadhi, and Prajnatara was the holder of the Zen samadhi, the self-fulfilling samadhi. We can imagine that when Bodhidharma and Prajnatara were sitting together, that Prajnatara said, "Here's a new samadhi that you might be interested in. The wonderful principles of zazen." Bodhidharma listened and aroused supreme wisdom. Then Prajnatara said, "You have now acquired everything there is to know about all things. At least all important things. Dharma means greatness of comprehension, greatness of penetrating all things. So you should be named Dharma." Thus he changed his name to Bodhidharma, which is what we often do at ordination, or we receive the precepts, we get a new name. Maybe more in accord with how our Dharma life. So thus, Bodhidharma was now Bodhidharma. Having left home and having received the Dharma, Shukke and Denpo. He left home and having the Dharma transmitted to him, Bodhidharma knelt and asked, "Since I have obtained the Dharma, to what land should I go to do Buddha work?" So like, "Thank you very much, teacher, for passing on everything that I need to me, and now how can I go help people?" all these, seems like you've already been doing this in Kerala for a while, so maybe the people around here in southern India don't need my help anymore. Where should I go to do Buddha work? Shouldn't we spread this thing around? Isn't it the most excellent, greatest jewel? So Prajnatara said, though you have received the Dharma, you should stay a while in southern India. Wait until 67 years after my death. And, you know, as I calculate this, in these days, is still the case in India, it says here, receive the full precepts. And usually that means like the full ordination, you have to be 20 years old, like minimal. And still the case, the Buddha set that up. And so if Bodhidharma was like a minimum of 20 at the time his teacher said this, then he's going to be 87 by the time he should go to China. So at least the way it's translated, I think that I don't know if there's some relation, but that research assistant of G.U. Kenneth Roshi, in her kind of in that story of Prajnatara, it said Prajnatara lived to be 67 years old. So there could be some translation issues going on here. But all the Denka Roku versions say 67 years after my death. Then go to China and contact those with a large capacity for Dharma. Bodhidharma asked, will they be able to become great vessels of Dharma there? Will difficulties arise there after a while? Prajnatara said, those who will realize Bodhi or awakening in that land of China are beyond number. Some slight difficulties may arise, but you'll be able to handle them. When you arrive there, do not stay in the south of China, because they only value conditioned merit, and they don't see the true principle of the Buddhas. So in this way, Bodhidharma carefully received the seal and the prediction, and then he attended Prajnatara for 40 years. So this makes the story even more, right? He's 20 years old. He attends like the Jisha for Prajnatara for 40 more years, and now he's 60. And then Prajnatara dies. So 60 plus 67 years would be 127 before he leaves for China. So, but you know, in the old days, the sages, you know, had, I don't know, special medicines or something. They could live like really, really long time. But here, when 61 years had passed, I guess after Prajnatara died, he knew that conditions were ripe in China. So he skipped 5 years because he was getting old. He's like, I'm 122. Like, I better go soon. He went to the king, who we don't know who the king was, but you can imagine maybe it was one of his brothers, right? Because they were the princes. And said, I must honor the three treasures and promote benefit for all. When conditions are ripe in China and I finish my work, I will return. The king wept with grief and asked, what's so bad about this country? What's so auspicious about that land? In any case, when your work in China is finished, please come back. Don't forget the land of your parents here in India. They went together to the port, and the king personally saw him off. Then Bodhidharma spent 3 years crossing the ocean and arrived in South China on the 21st day of the 9th month in the year 527. So, 122, and 3 years of ship travel, and 125. The first thing he did was have an audience with Emperor Wu of Liang, as in the well-known story. And I think it's just so great that Kazon doesn't even bother to tell the story. He says, as in the well-known story, because all the Zen people in his time knew that story. But what I think is so great is so many Zen people in America know this story, that it's kind of like a well-known story here. Who would have ever guessed? But anyone not know the story of Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu? Well, just briefly. Bodhidharma comes to southern China and somehow has this audience with the emperor, and the emperor, remember, Buddhism's thriving now. There's 2 million monks in China, and the emperor is a big part of creating the institutional Buddhism. And the emperor says, well, how much merit have I gained from promoting the Dharma like this? And Bodhidharma says, vast emptiness, no merit. Which I think in ancient times and modern times, it's kind of gutsy to talk that way to an emperor, especially as a kind of mendicant beggar from a foreign land. And the emperor said, who are you anyway? And Bodhidharma said, I don't know. That's the well-known story. And the emperor didn't get it.
Didn't he later ask about someone else about who the heck Bodhidharma?
Yeah, he asked his kind of assistant, who was that masked man? And the minister juror said, don't you know that was Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva Mahasattva, transmitting the Buddha mind seal? But you missed it. So it's interesting that Bodhidharma is known as a kind of a manifestation of the Bodhisattva of great compassion, Avalokiteshvara. We might think Bodhidharma is more of a Manjushri, sword-wielding kind of guy, but he's long been associated with total compassion. He's just a love ball, Bodhidharma. So here's some stories about this love ball. So this is what Prajnatara was referring to when he said, do not stay in the south, where they're just into conditioned merit. We want people who are open to the unconditioned emptiness of merit. Thus, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and soon arrived at Shaolin Monastery on Mount Sung and stayed in the East Hall there. No one could figure him out. That's a nice translation. No one could figure him out. He just did zazen all day long. They called him the wall contemplating Brahmin. They called him a Brahmin or a Brahmana because he was from India. And they thought he must be a Brahmin priest, because those are the meditators in India. And it's Khan, as in Kanzeon, means to gaze upon, right? To see the cries of the world, But also kan means to contemplate, like the cries of the world. So here it says, the wall contemplating Brahman, but you could also translate it as the wall gazing Brahman. That's what they call them. And that's why, to this day, we sit gazing at the wall during Sesshin. And because he sat in this cave and faced the wall, apparently. He's the instigator of that wall gazing practice. He did not speak boisterously or lightly about the Dharma for 9 years. So let's see now. Well, we said after the ship journey he was 125, so those 9 years of Zazen, he was just coolly sitting there. 133? Okay. And I think he pretty much died after the 9 years of Zazen. That was enough.
But he had to transmit first.
Yes, during those 9 years.
During those 9 years,
he had transmission. Yeah, we're going to hear that story. Some pieces. Here it just says, 9 years later, after having conferred his skin, flesh, bones, and marrow to Dao Fu, Dao Yu, Sung Chur, and Hui Ke. So here's another woman ancestor, disciple of Bodhidharma, Acharya Sung Chur, we chanted her name this morning. All the great ancestors have women disciples and women teachers sometimes. He knew that the potential had matured after passing on his skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. At that time, there were two non-believers named Bodhi Ruchi and Vinaya Master Guang Tung. So, usually when they say like outside the way, they mean kind of like non-Buddhist practitioners, but here they're Buddhist monks, but maybe the implication is they don't get the Zen thing. Seeing the Bodhidharma's merits spread through the land and people turning to him and respecting him, they could not help being angry and indignant. They not only hurled stones and knocked out his front teeth, poor 125-year-old Bodhidharma, they also tried 5 times to poison him. He was a strong guy, right? Lived that long. On the sixth poisoning attempt, he put the poison on a big rock and the rock shattered. He thought, conditions for the teaching here have ended. He thought, I've received the seal and prediction from my teacher, witnessed great conditions in China, and realized for sure that there was a capacity for the Dharma of the great vehicle, the Mahayana. But after meeting Emperor Wu of Liang, the potential was not fulfilled, and I did not find a person that could receive this. But while sitting alone in stillness, I found the great being Shun Guang. His other name is Hui Ke, the second ancestor, and transmitted all of the way I had acquired to him. The work is finished and the conditions have ended, so I should leave. So saying, he sat upright and died. He was buried on Bear's Ear Peak. Although it's been said that he later met Sung Yun in the Onion Range of mountains in Turkestan, really he was buried on Bear's Ear Peak, and that's the truth. Kazan says. I once visited Shaolin Monastery in central China, which is also the home of all martial arts. Yeah? And I think it's kind of known as like all kind of martial arts maybe originated at Shaolin, maybe with Bodhidharma, they sometimes say. And so these days, it's a Zen Buddhist monastery, but really it's like It's like a giant martial arts camp. And there's like literally like thousands of kids like all like out in the fields all around in these like huge formations, all like in sync doing like kung fu and and there's also all these film crews around making martial arts movies, even while I was there, with like, you know, dry ice and making smoke and stuff, and people doing all these backflips. But there's a hall where it's like the old Zendo, where they have like a statue of Bodhidharma with spider webs growing on it and collecting dust. And I went to morning services in the big old monastery, and they're a little bit loose. Compared to other Chinese monasteries I visited, they were, Shaolin was like, I think they're really just more into the martial arts thing. But of course, there's Buddhist monks chanting the sutras of the Buddha like we do, bowing and offering incense. And then a nice hike to get the blood flowing outside Shaolin Monastery. You got into the fields, beautiful kind of rural area. And there's, on the way up to Sungshan, Mount Sung, where Bodhidharma's cave is, there's this little temple. This was like 20 years ago, so it's hard to remember the details, but there was this little like hermitage, maybe like the size of the Zendo, that was a tiny women's monastery. So cool. And I do not speak Chinese, and I was with maybe one American friend who didn't speak Chinese. And somehow along the, I was just visiting Chinese monasteries and trying to practice in China, and somehow we realized that it was going to be really hard to get around this country without knowing Chinese. In fact, we had some like nights in train stations and stuff like that. Chinese is hard. I mean, Japanese is hard too, but it's much easier to pronounce. Chinese has all these tones. So you say something and it's like, it sounds just like it looks written, and then they have no idea what you're saying. And then finally they understand and they say, just the word that you say back, oh, like that. I'm like, I thought that's what I was saying. Anyway, this is why we hooked up with this monk, and I forget how. It was like a monk and two nuns also going on pilgrimage to these Buddhist sites in China. They didn't speak a word of English, we didn't speak a word of Chinese. But we were practitioners of the way. It was a great joy to somehow we figured out that we were like going to the same places, and so they could help us get tickets and stuff, right? They were also traveling like low class on the, you know, crowded buses and things like this. So that's how we found, they must have known about this little women's monastery. Otherwise, I would never have knocked on the door of some random place. And we went and we had lunch there. It was the sweetest thing. It was small. There were maybe just three or four nuns, women priests, and it was lunchtime, and they had extra, and they just served us all some sort of soup. And then we went up the mountain. Bodhidharma's cave is like the size of that Chidin closet. It's small, and there's a statue of Bodhidharma in there with an incenser in front, and no one was really up there, so we could just sit in his cave for a while. Way up the mountain, if you have, you know, like stone stairs carved into the stone, and like this to get up there. And could really feel this ancestor who lived so long ago there and was the source of Zen throughout East Asia. The wall-gazing Brahmin who, I think, you know, it says he was at Shaolin, but it seems like he was just 9 years in this cave that he didn't really hang out in the temple. There was, a temple there, but he just sat in the cave up there and then died. So the way I picture it is like these transmissions were happening in this cave. That's how I'm imagining it, that these people came to him up there. I think so, yeah. Sometimes it's described like he's outside, it says outside a window, so maybe the cave had a wall with a window at that time. So it's not totally clear, but it was, you know, north enough in China too that, you know, winters are like deep snow. Now this is Kazan. Kazan's commentary. There's no doubt that Bodhidharma was the first ancestor in China due to the prediction and instruction of the 27th ancestor. At the beginning, when Bodhidharma was a prince, Venerable Prajnatara asked, with reference to the discussion of the jewel, what among all things is signless? Here it actually says formless, but it's a bad translation. And even his footnote says it really is like signless. But so why did he translate it formless? I don't know. They're a little different feeling, don't you think? So for our Sanskrit fans, this would be animita. Animita would be signless. In the old teachings, they talk about these three doors of liberation. Emptiness, shunyata, signlessness, animita, and aimlessness, apranihita. This is in early teachings, but maybe more emphasized in Mahayana. Sometimes called three samadhis. And in Japanese, we signlessness is muso, and it's the same muso as in our robe chant. Muso fukudene literally means a signless merit field robe. We translate it as field far beyond form and emptiness. Muso fukudene, a signless blessings field of merit, robe. So Thich Nhat Hanh, I think, has a nice explanation of signs, nimitta here. He says, sign means the appearance or the object of our perception. When we see something, a sign or image appears to us. If water is in a square container, its sign is squareness. That's how it appears to us. When water is in the form of ice, its sign is solidity. That's how it appears to us. For chemists, water has the sign H2O. Signs are instruments for our use, but they're not absolute truth, and they can mislead us. When we free ourselves from signs, we can enter the heart of reality. Thich Nhat Hanh says in one of his more deeper comments. So signless is like where we can't get a hold of the characteristics or the ways that we know things. It's not so much that like all sights and sounds disappear, but we just know that things are not the signs of them. They're actually free of signs. ice is actually free of a sign of solidity. It appears solid, but it's not inherently what ice actually is. It's ice is actually signless. No signs stick to it. So Pajantara says, what among all things is signless? And Bodhidharma says, non-arising is signless. It's hard to argue with that. Not, maybe we could even say anything that arises has signs. That's why we say it appears to arise because there's some sign there. We can grasp it as arising. But non-arising is signless. And I think this means not just that we're looking at a seed before it arises as a flower. I think non-arising here means right in the things that we're looking at, their true nature is actually non-arising. Things don't really arise, and therefore they don't really have signs. Non-arising is signless. Now, then Kazan says, now, even if you say, quote, nothingness, unquote, really, that's not signless. Maybe because you said it, in quotes. Nothingness, isn't that signless? Yeah, it's still an idea. You can understand this realm as inaccessible, like a 10,000 fathom high cliff, or as bright the 100 grasses, which is a saying of Layman Pong. You can think of all things as being nothing other than that, and that all things abide in their dharma positions, which is a Dogen quote from the Genjo Koan. These are all these things in quotes, these great Zen sayings that we know and love. But all these things are not at all non-arising. Therefore, they're not signless. And I think what he's driving out here is all these great phrases are still like ideas. Just if we're putting forth these great Zen quotes. What about bright, the tips of the 100 grasses? That's pretty signless, isn't it? Well, that's just an old Zen saying. It seems like there's some signs there that we're holding it by. So Kazan says, prior to the separation of heaven and earth, how can you distinguish ordinary and holy? In this realm, not a single thing can sprout, not a speck of dust can defile. However, this is not the realm of the original non-existence of anything. Right now, it's empty and intelligent, alert and undazzled. For me, I think this is the central sentence of this chapter of what we're talking about: signlessness and the jewel that's the most precious. Another translation of this central sentence. Naturally, there's a vastly spacious, numinous clarity, perfectly alert and not obscure. Not obscured. Numinous is a word we don't use so much. The character here is usually would be translated more like spiritual or spirit even. Naturally, there's a vastly spacious, spiritual brightness, perfectly alert and not obscure. All right, another third translation. Empty and open, spiritually aware, wide awake and unbefuddled. This is what's truly signless. And that is certainly not nothingness, right? Keizan's emphasizing nothingness is not signless. It's before the separation of heaven and earth, but it's not original non-existence. It's open, bright, awake and aware. Keizan goes on, nothing can be compared to this realm, nor does anything else accompany it. It is, therefore, the greatest of the great, and it's said that the great is called inconceivable. It's also said the inconceivable is called dharma nature. Sanskrit, dharmata. Not even a priceless jewel can compare with it. Not even the clear light of mind can represent it. Bodhidharma said, this is a worldly light and does not qualify as the highest. I consider the light of wisdom to be the highest. Though this is the way he understood it and what he said was truly natural wisdom, he did zazen again for 7 days. When he heard 27th ancestor express the wonderful principles of zazen, he aroused the unsurpassed wisdom of the way. Thus, you must understand this example of Bodhidharma shows that by reaching such a realm through careful discernment, you will understand right away that awakening which the Buddhas and ancestors verified and clarify what former Buddhas have already verified and become descendants of Buddhas and ancestors. Even though he seemed to have natural wisdom, he again aroused the supreme wisdom of the way. Later, he was careful in his attention to guard and protect the Dharma in the future. He served at the side of his teacher and investigated thoroughly and in detail for 40 years, then spent 60 years without forgetting the prediction about the future, then spent 3 years crossing the ocean. At last he arrived in an unknown land, and during his 9 years of zazen, he acquired a successor with a great capacity for Dharma, and for the first time spread the Tathagata's true Dharma in China, thus requiting the vast debt to his teacher. His hardships were the greatest, his austerities the most austere. And Keizan, in his usual style, says, however, practitioners these days still hope it will be easy. Despite the degeneracy of the times and the weakness of capacities, I'm afraid that people like these who say they've understood what they haven't really are proud and arrogant, who should retire like those 500 arhats who left when the Lotus Sutra was about to be taught. People, if you thoroughly penetrate the foregoing story, understand its loftiness more and more, smash the mind. Maybe any idea of the mind, we just smush. Is that a little less violent than smash? How would we just smush the mind into like a ball of putty and just place it down behind our seat with our Oryoki bowls and let it sit there with us during Zacin? Intimately discern the way, you will receive mysterious help from the Buddhas and directly share what the Buddhas and ancestors have verified. Do not think that a morsel of knowledge or half an understanding is sufficient. Maybe in Zacin we're allowed to talk this way and hear this kind of thing, right? But the ancestors were strong. They want us to fully practice and realize the way. And it might take 137 years or so. We have time. Again, I have some humble words, Keizan says. Would you like to hear them? He always finishes the chapter with a verse. There is no distinction or location, no edges or boundaries, no outside. How could anything be larger than an autumn hare? Apparently. yeah, that kind. Not the rabbit kind. Apparently in Chuang Tzu, great Taoist ancestor, in a chapter on equality of all things, says, there's nothing in the world bigger than the tip of an autumn hair. And apparently autumn hair is like when the fur of an animal in the autumn starts to get kind of downy and fluffy to get ready for winter. So it's really fine, soft hair. I think that is autumn hair. The finest hair. But Chuang Tzu says, there's nothing in the world bigger than the tip of an autumn hair. And Mount Tai, this great mountain, is very tiny. This chapter on equality of all things. Before Buddhism came to China, it was paved the way, right? So Keizan says, there's no distinction or location. It's empty, bright, always awake and aware, with no distinctions, actual distinctions in this field of awareness, no edges or boundaries of this field of awareness, and nothing outside it. How could anything be larger than an autumn hare or smaller than Mount Everest in this realm? Thank you, Bodhidharma. You got us here. We have a perfectly fine wall for the next couple of days. In fact, an even smoother wall than the wall of Bodhidharma's cave. So we can let our mind become as smooth as the wall, where there's no outside, where the wall is not outside, or inside, or in between. May this merit equally extend to every being and place, so that all may realize Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, and I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, and I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.